Hi guys, I'm Dana Al-Hanbali and this is Something to Consider. Today we're exploring the deeply personal and complex journey of identity, how it's shaped by culture, heritage, and the stories we inherit. Last year I attended the Arab Child Summit, and the event opened with a keynote speech that left a profound impression on me. It was a powerful reflection on identity, belonging, and the resistance required to reclaim and protect them. Our guest today shared her story as someone navigating the layers of identity, growing up in the West, carrying the weight of historical erasure, and now raising a daughter to embrace her roots in a world that often challenges them. She spoke about the grief of an education system that excluded her heritage, the shame imposed by prejudice, and the courage it takes to unlearn those narratives. As a mother, she's making intentional choices to rewrite the story for her child, like moving her from a Western curriculum to an Arab-speaking one, ensuring she grows up knowing her language, her people, and her culture. It was a speech about courage, grief, and hope, and it left me reflecting deeply on how we shape our identities and pass them on to the next generation. I'm honored to welcome Dr. Saliha Afridi, a clinical psychologist and the founder of the Lighthouse Arabia, who is on a mission to destigmatize mental health in the region. Dr. Saliha, welcome to the show, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are enjoying a gorgeous rainy day in Dubai today, so I'm very excited that we're in the recording studio. These are my vibes.
And it's so amazing how the weather changes suddenly.
I know.
January 1st, right?
I know, right? So I love it. I've been waiting for it. And I feel like today's set kind of is a nod to that. It's a very cozy feel. Yes. Dr. Saliha, I usually kick off with a question that provides the audience, our listeners, with a little bit of context about your background that to an extent sets the stage for the conversation that we're going to have. So if I were to ask you, can you give us a little bit of context on your background and where you come from to set the stage for this conversation?
So this is a complicated question. I think that's a complicated question for anyone that lives in Dubai, but more so for people who are from all over and identify with being from all over. Mm. But I will give you the standard answer. I am a Pathan Pakistani woman who grew up in the US, and I moved to Dubai about 16 years ago. And I'm a clinical psychologist by profession. I'm a wife, a mother, a daughter, a daughter-in-law, an aunt, and all of that is something I encounter every day. So I'm mentioning it every day. I live in a system where all of my family lives next to me. I am here.
I love that. Your story, I feel like, is one, like many of us, I can definitely relate, carries a lot of layers. Pathan, Muslim, Arab, mother. Do you feel like you sometimes need to choose which part of your identity to lean into, or do you feel like they all coexist equally?
This, I think being a hyphenated identity, being a 1.5 generation, also probably known as a third culture kid, lends itself to being a shapeshifter in some way. We walk on bridges all the time. We are in between spaces all the time. And that for me has something that I'm comfortable living on the hyphen. And so you don't really belong in any one place. So you can lean in any one direction at any one point. Those are all the external identity, you know, sort of identifiers. And so, yeah, I don't think I choose one or the other. They all coexist. And I think that is easier for people who have done the work of figuring out what their hyphens are. And I think I've done that work. So for me, it is a little bit easier to not choose one or the other.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I like that. I like the idea of doing the work to figure out what the hyphens are, because that requires a certain level of introspection around what really is identity. So if I were to ask you, if you were to put a definition to it, what does identity mean to you?
Come on. Identity. It is a really complicated answer. And everyone, I'm really glad that you said, what does it mean to you? Because I'm not here speaking as a psychologist. I'm speaking as Saleha here. Mm. So what does it mean to me? It is something that is ever-changing. Mm. My identity from a week ago, a month ago, is going to be different because I'm constantly doing the work of integration. I am constantly doing the work of introspection, reflection, integration, learning about myself, understanding myself, understanding how each encounter may change me, mm-hmm. and saying, how did that change me? So it's a journey of becoming, mm-hmm. rather than just something I am. And I've never been comfortable with, this is who I am. I'm always going to say, this is who I am right now. This is who I am today. And know that that is a fluid, dynamic process that's going to be ever-changing. And so identity is, it is ever-changing. But then there is some parts of us, for example, our cultural identity. That is our roots. Mm. That is our foundation. Mm. And that foundation is a ground that you sort of stand on, which then allows you to move. You need to have certain foundations, the values, community, tradition. Those are things that are the foundation. But the foundation is not who you are. It's just a foundation.
Mm. That's really interesting because I completely agree. I don't think identity is something that is simple. And I don't think it's something that's simple to define. But I also feel like the world sometimes imposes this need to fit us into very neat, tidy little boxes that make sense. And I think that as we get older, and I'll speak for myself, the older I get, the more I feel I don't want to say the need, because I don't think I need to, but I do feel like it becomes easier for me to navigate obstacles and struggles and challenges in the world when I have more clarity and intentionality behind defining what my identity is. I feel like, though, you know, we all have different definitions of what identity means, what being a woman means, what being Muslim means, what being from a particular country or culture means. And I think that sometimes we fall into the trap of thinking that we have to abide by the rules of society. How do you stay grounded when the world's definitions don't necessarily match your own, whether that's culture or gender?
Well, this is something I would say My earliest memories are of this. I would say, looking back at my life, even as a very young child, I questioned what people were telling me. So I was sort of born with a very questioning, a very rebellious spirit. This was not something that I encountered growing up, but very early on, that if someone says you can't eat with the left hand, I would wonder why. And I would try to, you know, like, why are you telling me this? Where did you come up with this? That kind of curiosity, that kind of rebelliousness was innate. And I grew up, I was born in Pakistan, and quite a, you know, traditional community, I would say. My father is not very traditional. We moved to the U.S. when I was 9 years old, or eight years old, then turned nine soon thereafter. And so, I mean, he was always the one who was sort of pushing the boundaries, even within his community. But I grew up in a traditional community, and it's still a very traditional community. This is a community where women didn't go to college. This is a community where women didn't work. And girls were a certain way, and boys were a certain way. And girls wore dresses, and boys wore pants. And for me, it was like, but why? But pants are a little bit more comfortable when you're kind of rolling around on the ground. Like, for me, it was like, why am I doing that? And this was very, very early. And so that is part of my personhood, my spirit, my soul, I would even say. Then I moved to the U.S. And so, actually going back, I did do a lot of things that the boys did. And then I got called out for it. Like, you don't act like this. Girls don't do this. And it was just like, well, I do. Mm. Girls don't do this, but I do. So I must not be a girl. Mm. Like, in the way that you think I am a girl. So here became my questioning of gender identity. I must not be a girl in the way you think I'm a girl. Then it was also the way then the religion was communicated to me as I moved to the U.S. You know, God is this punishing and force. But I didn't feel that. I really felt God in everything that I looked at. I mean, God made plants and God made trees. Like, that can't be a punishing God. He seems like there must be more to this God than this one who's just judging and punishing all the time. Mm-hmm. So my God will be different from your God. So my religion, I was a Muslim, but my relationship to God was defined by me. And so my religion was different than the religion the other. I was doing it out of a place of curiosity and connection rather than a place of fear and judgment. Mm-hmm. Then I was a child. My race all of a sudden became a thing. I was 8, 9 years old. This is early in your identity formation years, right? This is when identity starts to become a thing in identity development. And I remember thinking, wait, all of a sudden, people are looking at the color of my skin. When I was in Pakistan, that's not a thing. Racial identity is not a thing in Pakistan. Mm. It only becomes a thing when you are different. And all of a sudden, I am a Pakistani, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Pathan. And the way people saw me was not how I saw myself. I was now a minority. Mm. I didn't feel like a minority. I also, you know, eventually when I moved into college, didn't look like one either. I was passing. So I could move between whatever I wanted to be. I could look Italian. I could look Brazilian. I could look Russian. I could look, you know, so it was then I had to assert my identity. So there was a constant flux as to what people were telling me and versus what I felt I was. And so identity has always been something I have been actively shaping for myself. Mm. I grew up in the Gulf War. Those were my teenage years where Muslims were really the bad guys. Sadly, it still seems to be the case in the popular culture and media. And they became the really bad guys at that time. But I didn't feel like one. Nobody I knew was one. What was this? And so, and then when I went to college, there was 9/11. Constantly questioning the dominant cultures. But really, it became very clear to me when I read Noam Chomsky in college. Mm. I encountered Noam Chomsky, and he talked about manufacturing consent and indispensable power, these books that were formative to my identity formation. It was just like, you don't get to manufacture me. You don't get to manufacture my identity. And so I then started to take a lot more control consciously about my identity. I then graduated with a major in cultural anthropology, just in pursuit of seeking, who am I if I am not Pakistani and I am not American and I'm not Muslim and I'm not just these things. I am all of these things. Mm-hmm. That's where I started to own the hyphen. Mm. And I saw hyphen as a place of great power, great tension, great possibility, and it became a bridge. Mm. I was going to be the person who would live on the bridge. I would never live in one place or the other. I would never belong in one place or the other. And that for people is a very painful place. I don't belong anywhere. For me, it felt like, well, that means I must belong everywhere. Like, for me, it always was an optimistic place. It's okay, I don't belong anywhere. I belong everywhere. I belong on the hyphen. And I will be the cultural translator. Mm. I will be the place in between. I will go from you and I will tell them what you are saying. And I will go from you and I'll tell them what you're saying. Because I can do that. Mm. I can communicate. I'm a cultural communicator. And for me, that became a very powerful place. And then since then, I've just continued to love the hyphens. You know, for one of my doctoral program essays, they ask you, like, tell us about yourself. And it was like, oh, what do I tell you?
The worst question.
And it was just all hyphens.
Oh, wow.
All hyphens. There was no sentence. There was no paragraph. Let me give you all the hyphens that I am, including chocolate lover or woman or wife or mother or sister. There are so many hyphens, and I don't have to choose. I am all of the above and probably none of the above at the same time.
All of the above and none of the above. I love that. Two things stick out from what you said. This idea of being in a questioning cycle of not necessarily following suit with whatever narrative you were being told, which I think is important. And I feel like that's something I can relate to and I've experienced. And funny enough, even growing up, you know, I used to hang out. I was the only girl amongst a lot of male cousins. So I used to play with the boys a lot. And I found it interesting that this idea of questioning or being rebellious was always associated with boys and with men. And I never really quite understood why. And funny enough, the older I got, the more I found myself in spaces that were male dominated, because I felt like I always had this longing to question and assert and be as authentically myself as I can and should be. But I've always struggled. I've struggled in the hyphenated space because maybe probably not until recently where I've embraced being that cultural communicator. I've always been told that it's like this amazing superpower to have, but I was stuck in the mindset of, I love the word you used, just passing. I can pass for anything, which always felt like it was a judgment of, yeah, we'll let you through. You're not enough, but we'll let you through. And it's really difficult. And I feel like in coming into my own today, there's a lot that I need to let go of. So there was almost a grieving process to my identity that I've had to go through in trying to figure out and find my identity, or at least the one that I don't want to say come to terms with, but the one that I've accepted and embraced. And I'm wondering, did you carry any sort of grief? I mean, I love that you looked at it from the perspective of being super optimistic, but I feel like in unlearning things, unlearning parts of yourself, or maybe detaching yourself from definitions, I feel like there's a grief that comes from that. Do you ever feel like maybe there's a fine line between processing that and actually feeling it?
I think grief... for sure, there is, not just was, there is so much grief. We are told so many things about who we are and how we should be by the dominant culture, by oppressive narratives, as a woman, as a Muslim, as a Pakistani. You don't even know. You're not even conscious of what you've internalized. This internalized oppression, internalized colonialism, internalized racism, that takes a lifetime almost to undo. What do I believe about myself that is actually not true? I am not this. I am not this. This is constantly happening. I'm in my therapeutic process. I've been in a therapeutic process for the last decade. And almost every month I will come up with, but I thought I was that, but I am no longer. And because we are constantly becoming, we're constantly changing. You are not the same person you were last year. Right? And you are different. So there's constant grief about letting go of who you were and becoming who you are. So this grief is a constant companion on my journey. But for sure, there is so much grief about what I internalized around Muslims growing up in my formative years. Like, no one taught me the good we did in the world. Mm. No one talks about that history. And history is written by the one who has power. And power really shapes our identity. So who are the forces in power that shaped my identity? Mm. Whether it's my Pakistani Pathan community, which also has very oppressive narratives about who I can be and cannot be. Whether it was the dominant white Midwest community or the media, everyone had something to say, which doesn't resonate with my soul, but which felt violent from my soul. But it was something I just said, well, this is must, everyone is saying it must be how it is. Mm. So that unlearning had to happen. And a lot of that happened in my 20s, but it is an ongoing process. Mm. A lot of that happened post October 7th for a lot of the people in the world, where we are now questioning everything that was told to us. Not just what was told to us about Muslims, but what was told to us about justice, humanity, international law. We're questioning everything, and there's a lot of grief. And there's a lot of loss.
Yeah. That resonates so much. I'm glad that we're able to come to terms with naming it as grief, but I have to say, especially after October 7th, I don't even want to say I was made aware. I feel like I had the life slapped out of me in a way where I started to realize there were so many things that I had accepted as true about my culture, my identity, my religion, without even realizing that I had accepted it. I did not realize how much permission I had given through my upbringing, through my education, and through my ownership and command of the English language.
Yes.
I have zero issue with speaking English. I love it. It's a very expressive language, but I'm almost resentful. I'm resentful at my ability to carry myself in English because that came at a cost of me not being able to do that in my mother tongue, which is Arabic. And that has so much to do with the quote unquote best education I was given. And I have no doubt that at the time, my parents, you know, they wanted to give me the best of the best. And the framing was always that the West is the best. So I find that I'm quite angry, you know, with this grief, I'm also quite angry. And I'm wondering, you know, how you talked about being on this therapeutic journey where, you know, you're talking to someone about it. But is it normal that I feel like I don't have anyone to talk to about it? And is it important for us to have these conversations? Because I also feel like a lot of people don't want to have them because they're uncomfortable. You know, what's been done is done. Let's just figure out a way to move on and move forward. But I still need to acknowledge what has happened. And does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah.
So a few things you said. You said it feels like grief, but it feels like anger. Anger is not a feeling. Grief is not a feeling. At least from my experience, grief is a whole experience and it has many feelings in it. Mm. It has anger, it has regret, it has sorrow, it has anguish, it has agony, it has all those feelings, all sort of in the full experience of grief. So if you really fully experience grief, it will transform you. It is like, you know, the fire through which the phoenix then can rise if you really fully experience grief. Mm. Most people don't. Mm. The past is the past. Let's move forward. Go learn your language and get on with your life, right? This is what we will say. But you do your life story a great disservice if you don't honor your story. You don't honor the whole story. And this is what I feel that I do in, and I call it a therapeutic process, although I probably should more accurately call it analysis, because that's what it has been. I'm not in treatment, but I am in exploration about myself, my story, my soul, my identity, all of that is a journey, and I'm on that journey. So you can be in analysis for decades because it's an ongoing unfolding of your identity and ongoing becoming
like we said. So that's the first thing that I would say. So yes, it is important to acknowledge all the full experience of grief, and also to say that you don't have to talk to anyone. It's okay if you don't, but it would be so much better if you did. Mm. It would be so much better for you and the ground that is inside of you. Mm. We all have a ground. And in order to make it to that ground, we've got to go in, into the inner journey. Mm. And that for me is what analysis slash therapy is. To work with a professional who is a depth psychologist. So I'm not talking about CBT or ACT or DBT. I'm not talking about depressed or anxious, although those can be great doorways in. When you have those symptoms, they're a great doorway into the inner journey. But you can actually just say, I want to know who I am. Mm. I want to know who I'm becoming. I want to know what is important to me. I want to know what are my triggers. Why am I reacting this way? You can just go in with that question, but work with someone who's depth oriented, who is an analyst or who's a depth psychologist, who really knows the terrain, the inner terrain. That for me would be a very important life companion to have, who will walk alongside and help you make sense of your experience and make meaning out of your experience. What does it mean that you believed West was best? Mm. What does that mean for you? Like what fragmented off and you dissociated from like your Arabness? What does that mean about the Arabness in you if West is best? What does that mean about you if you don't speak your language? What does that mean? What have I internalized about Arabs? Oh, it's beneath, you know, it's not good enough. You know, what does that mean? But you are saying that about yourself now. Mm. So what internalized hatred or oppression do you need to contend with or you need to unpack and then set yourself free from? Mm-hmm. Liberation is not just an external thing. Inner liberation is the end goal. Mm. When we are free from even our own constructs, which oftentimes religion, race, culture, these kinds of things can actually bind you. And so how do you liberate yourself but still be yourself?
Yeah.
From, you know, and that's the journey, I think. If you are longing for, you should take. Mm. Don't listen to what people say. Well, what's the point? You don't know what the point is. We don't know what the point is. Just go in and figure it out for yourself.
That's so powerful, because I feel like, you know, I've had the privilege of speaking to multiple doctors in this space, and healers and people who, to an extent, have taken on this idea of reflection and this internal journey to the next level. But I've never looked at it from the perspective that you're describing, which is an analysis and almost a guide to figuring out who I am. I always thought it was a solution to a potential problem, which says a lot. But that being said, what I find interesting, you're talking to someone who has that analytical perspective that may be able to guide me in this internal conversation that I'm having with myself. But I feel like in this feeling, what I've found emerging, especially in the past 2 years, are the emergence of what I guess they're called sharing circles. But these circles that have been coming up in communities, of whether they're forums or sharing circles, whatever it is you want to call them, but they're popping up in communities that feel that they are going through kind of a crisis of identity, and they're trying to figure so much out, and they're doing it in these safe spaces where there is no judgment and these conversations are being had. And what I find so interesting about the emergence of these spaces, because they have existed in some way, shape, or form in many ways over time, but what's interesting about their emergence in the past 2 years is that for the first time in my life, as alone as I have felt in my journey of identity, I'm meeting people that are very similar to me. And I'm realizing how much these Arabs, these havesies, these third world kids, these people that don't have the command of Arabic that they wish that they had, that went into Western school systems, that are still questioning things about their religion and their upbringing. And so I'm meeting them in these spaces, and I never knew that they existed. And that was such a light bulb moment for me of so much of what I've missed out on in the formation of my identity was being around people that looked like me, spoke like me. And I don't know how to say that in a way that doesn't feel like I'm isolating others. It's just, there's something very powerful in being around your culture and your community. And I feel like I took that for granted. And the question that I'm leading to is, you made a very bold decision with your youngest daughter. You made a decision of wanting to take her out of a Western education system and put her in a public Arabic language and education system. I thought that was the bravest thing I've ever heard. Honestly, I remember that me and so many other women in the crowd, when you said that, our eyes were filled with tears, because so much of us question what our lives would have been like today if we had that opportunity. And I don't know why it's so emotional for us. I genuinely don't. But can you talk to us about why you made that decision?
I think the narrative about Arabs, so my daughter is Arab. I'm married to an Arab man from Yemen. My daughter is an Arab. And the narrative about Arabs right now, it's so polarized, right? There are many, many, many that are curious and open and embracing. And for the first time, seeing Arabs as humans. And then there are the others who are absolutely dehumanizing and just devaluing Arab lives, humans. And this tension is just getting bigger and bigger. And I really felt that. And my daughter is going to grow up Arab. And I want her to know who she is. I want her to know people that look like her, that sound like her, that speak in Arabic. And I will not have public opinion shape her understanding of who she is. So this is where what she reads in those books, I know what I read growing up. We, you know, Christopher Columbus was the savior. And I'm like, I know what we talked, what he discovered, and the language and how that shaped how this was the new world. And, you know, there was no necessarily talk about Native Americans and the Trail of Tears and the absolute genocide that happened in the United States before it became the United States. So those books, I don't want my daughter reading those books. I want her to learn about her land. I want her to learn about her religion. I want her to learn about her culture. And of course, we're going to learn about world history, and hopefully it will be through some kind of objectivity and not a Western narrative. And that for me was very important, because language shapes our identity. That's a fact. That's a fact. Language shapes our identity. And to step in to your identity and not have it be manufactured and not have it be, you know, structured by the dominant narrative is also a form of resistance. And that for me was very important. I've been a resistance fighter probably since, you know, a very young age, like I said, resisting public dominant narratives about what it was to be a woman, to be a Muslim, to be a Pakistani, to be brown, to be, etc. And now comes this. Mm-hmm. We will not let you define who we are. And so my conversations with my daughter are, you will speak Arabic and you will be proud and you are an Arab and you are a Muslim and you will be proud and you will speak English and you are also Pakistani and you are Pathan and you are, and you are, and you are all of these things, but you are your lineage, your people, your history. You must know that. That is your foundation, and that is being an Arab. So for me, that was very important and a very emotional decision as well, because I am not, I cannot be as involved in her academics. I don't speak Arabic. So her father has to be far more involved. But this is like, teach me, Salama. Teach me what you are doing. Tell me what you are doing. And so it's become a really beautiful process and something that she's very proud of, that she knows something that her mother doesn't. And I'm like, we're going to own that. So, yeah, identity, especially racial identity, can be a tool for resistance. We will not let you define who we are.
Mm. I love that. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for, I mean, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful because even in, you know, this is something that has changed the role that maybe you have with your daughter, very specifically when it comes to her education. I mean, obviously you're involved in other ways, but I just think that it's so brave. And I feel like a lot of us still fear what that would mean for their future, because we worry about the fact that, at least from the story that we are told, it does still feel like there are dominant forces at play. And because we care about the safety and the future and the prosperity of our kids and their kids and whatever, we want them to be able to survive in that. But yeah, I love the way you put it, resisting this idea of accepting a narrative that is being imposed on you that you did not participate in is a necessity in itself. Yeah. I love that. And I don't know why it makes us so emotional. Like while you were speaking, I kept wanting to cry because it's just, I don't know why. When you said in your speech, your beautiful speech, I'm not Arab, but my child is Arab. And so I am Arab too. It was such a powerful statement. I love that. And as an Arab, I accept that completely. But how has raising your daughter reshaped the way that you think about this idea of belonging?
So I have four children, and all my children are third culture kids. Third culture kids are basically, they don't belong to their host culture. They don't belong to their host culture. They don't belong to the culture that they were born in, and they kind of are an amalgamation of both of these cultures. So it's like a 1.5 generation for those who immigrated to different countries. I was a 1.5 generation. My children are third culture kids. And belonging for me has always been, because even when I lived in Pakistan, I didn't feel like I belonged there either. Mm. I was not like them. I questioned. I was curious. I was not like the others around me. So belonging for me has never been defined by people that look like me or sound like me, that dress like me. That doesn't give me a sense of belonging. Mm. That gives me a sense of identity and sense of history and sense of tradition, values. Okay, but belonging is like my soul tribe. Like, who are your soul people? And in order for you to know what your soul people are, you need to know your soul so that you recognize another when you meet them. And that for me has been a lifelong journey as a mother. Who are you really? Mm. Who are you really? Don't be defined by what your friends are doing. Don't be defined by what even I tell you. 'Cause maybe I'm wrong. Because I was told certain things by my family and I wasn't that. And so who are you really? Mm. Keep asking yourself, who am I now? Who am I really? And so find the people where you belong with. But then also know that there is a tradition and a culture and a people that also that you belong to. So there's this constant tension between, and that's the beautiful thing about being a third culture kid or a 1.5 generation is that you hold that tension because you don't belong here or there. You're not enough of anything. So that tension is always there. But out of that tension can come something really powerful is that you don't rigidly hold on to any one part of you. And so comes an easier way of sort of owning your personal identity, your authentic self. And so that's kind of what I tell my kids. By the way, Salama, who is in this Arabic curriculum, we have a tutor that she works with on science and mathematics and things that are in the English language. So we're preparing her for the world and also making sure that she stays connected to her roots. So it's constantly doing this dance of like, okay, remember your roots. Now, how do you stay in the world? So remember your roots. How do you stay in the changing world? Mm-hmm. And really identifying for them what our values are. Our values are very collectivistic in nature. You sacrifice for the group. You belong to the group, but you don't do self-betrayal. Mm-hmm. And so really getting quite nuanced in identity development is the journey that we are on. And that's the constant lectures that they will get from me. But also, they've also, you know, all of them have also had a therapeutic process that they engaged in on and off, questioning themselves, wondering about themselves, who am I, really?
I love that because also for me, in the way that I look at my relationship to my roots today, there was a time where I felt like one's attachment to their roots, and maybe that was the case a while back, and I've just changed and the world has just changed and evolved. But I always, there was a time when I did see it that your attachment to your roots in a way would limit you when in reality, it's the attachment to the roots that are going to help me grow my own branches and help me kind of figure out how I contribute to the world while not letting go of things that I still find essential to myself. So I love that. And I love that you made the distinction between identity and belonging, because I agree, they are two distinctly different things. I was listening to something the other day. I can't think of the ayah, but it had to do with something that was said in Islam. And when I think about Islam and I think about al-umma al-muslimin, al-umma, I don't know how to translate umma in English, but anyways, the group of Muslims globally, the people, I always used to think it came under a headline of just being Muslim. But the reference in this specific ayah was not speaking to Muslims, it was speaking to al-mu'mineen, the believers.
The believers.
And I thought that was the most beautiful, profound thing. And I don't know why I noticed it only recently. It's so incredible. And when I realized, you know, just by being part of a religion that embraces believers, what that did is it also opened the door to people that believe in so much more than just what their religion should be. It was people who chose to still believe in this idea of hope and change. I don't know if there's ever going to come a time where talking about Palestine is not going to hurt as much as it does. I keep getting asked, you know, it's been so long. It's been over 400 plus days. We're going on 2 years of this. And I keep getting asked this question by the same people of whether I still have hope. And it shocks me. It shocks me that how can you not forget your belief however you choose to practice religion, to live in a world where you don't have hope as a core belief or be someone that believes in something better, something good, something. I just find that very strange. But yeah, for a lot of people who have lost their identity or feel like maybe in their pursuit of understanding it more, they feel like they struggle to figure out who they are. Where do you think one would begin to find clarity? I love how you talked about this idea of questioning, mm-hmm. which I agree. And I love how you talked about this idea of having a guide to help you analyze. For me, it's been meeting people that I feel like are a little bit more like me. That it's helped me a lot. But for a lot of people that currently feel incredibly alone and feel like they don't have a place in this world that is actively not seeing them, where do they start?
The first place you always start is with yourself. You know, in one of my sessions, I said, I don't feel heard. I don't feel heard multiple times. And then I heard in my ear, in myself, I heard that, do you hear yourself? Do you listen? Do you pay attention? And that for me was like, oh, am I seeing myself? A lot of people want to be seen, but have you seen yourself? Do you know who you are? It has to start with you. And this longing to be seen may actually be coming from your soul. It may be coming from your soul that's saying, look at me. And we are just projecting that outwards and saying, Dana, look at me. But the soul is saying, no, you look at me. Who are you? Who am I? It may be that longing. So before you project that need onto someone else to see me, and we all have that need, I don't deny that. We want to be seen. And there is nothing that feels more like love. If I were to give it that, like if I could encapsulate an experience of love, it would be to be seen and be accepted for who you are. Mm-hmm. That for me is love. And so I don't deny that. But you've got to start with you. And I promise you that when you start to see you, when you started to see yourself, when you started to see your identity confusion, when you started to see your multiple identities, and you said, actually, I'm not just Palestinian, and I'm not, now I've got to find people who are not just, and they're not enough of, and then you found your people, but you first had to identify in you what you were or where you were not, and then the people came. So start with yourself. Really commit to, and like in a devoted sense, show up for yourself. Wonder about yourself. Be curious about yourself. Learn about yourself. That for me is the most important thing. And I know that on my journey that I have been on as a psychologist, but just as an introspective human being and a very curious human being, a very reflective human being my whole life, having that partner in analysis has been such a gift. It did take me a while, I have to say. So don't like, oh, it didn't work the first time. It didn't work the second time. You will find your person.
Yeah.
And it did take me 3 times till I found that person where I was like, she's the one. She's going to walk the path with me. But I had to encounter some disappointments where I didn't feel even seen by my own therapist. Mm. Because there were certain things that they just were not aligned with. They didn't, one of my therapists didn't believe in God. That's just not going to be someone who can walk the path with me. Like, there are certain things I need you to believe. I don't care which God, but you've got to believe in something higher, a higher power. And another therapist who really was a very older, like a much, much, much older woman in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Like, she was so disconnected from, like, the realities of my life that it just felt like, she was quite ingrained in her own judgments about me being a Muslim, me being from Dubai. You know, she thinks like everyone here had, I don't know, we all have like an oil field in our backyard. Like
Lamborghini in the parking lot.
Like, so I was like, so I'm like trying to, so it was so much about like telling her about this is what I'm not, that I couldn't get into a deeper process. Mm. And then I found someone. And the third time was a charm. But it does take a while. So I would say to the people, find a partner. And of course, friends are great and sharing communities are great. But having an analyst or a depth-oriented psychotherapist is a very different experience. Mm. That 1 hour is me. I just sit there and wonder about me. I don't have to hear about you.
Yeah.
And that is it. You go deeper and deeper and deeper into yourself. Mm. I've done other things to sort of work on figuring out more of myself and more of who I am. But maybe that will be for another. That will be for another time.
That's fair. Thank you. Thank you for that. I think that's actually really helpful. I do want to ask this just because I feel like this is something that would be helpful. I just want to make sure I phrase it right. As a friend, because taking that first step to opening up, especially from a cultural perspective, it's not something that's widely accepted, at least in my own circles of my own Arab community. Although it's become more mainstream now, I still think that people struggle and there's a fear of talking about not just your life, but just how you feel in general. So how do we support each other in figuring it out without judging them? There are a lot of people that internalize the pain of not feeling accepted or seen or understood. And that leads to a lot of issues in relationships. And this could be in family, you know, the relationship that we have with our parents who don't necessarily feel seen, heard, understood. They're kind of just continuing to be as they are. They're not interested in kind of reflecting on themselves or changing. And that can also exist in trying to find the right partner in life, you know, man, woman, whatever. How do we support each other? Especially if you yourself are someone who is introspective and you're on this journey and you're asking yourself, you're doing the work, you're asking the right questions, but the people around you aren't, and you want to support them. You want to support them without imposing your own revelations on them. What are the best ways to do that?
Support them with their difficult feelings?
Support them with them not wanting to get the help that they want or reflect on themselves. They're just struggling. And a lot of this is internalized. And that internalization shows up as anger, frustration, passive aggressiveness. Just not being okay with themselves is affecting how they act with the rest of the world or how they show up for the rest of the world. Mm.
So there's a few things you said. First thing I would say that, yes, therapy is not accepted and there's a stigma and there's taboo and it is not comfortable and you still should do it, Like, this is what I mean by I have never allowed myself to be defined by what is okay in a community. I moved to the UAE 16 years ago. There was no mental health clinic in Dubai. And I was one of the first that opened in the country. Mm. And it was like, it's never going to work. People are never going to talk. We don't do mental health. You know, I'm going to do it. You know, like, come on. Now, this is like doing the inner journey is an act of resistance, is an act of rebellion. Like, own that and be proud of it. And everyone will judge you. And people will say that what's wrong with her or she's crazy. And let them. You are still good in yourself. Like, this is where knowing yourself is so important, because then you are less affected by what other people say. So that's the first thing I will say. The second thing I will say is that as you go on your journey and as you do more of, you know, you become more of who you are and you step in more into your authentic self and you do more of the healing work. We all have a lot of trauma. We do more of that healing, you become more of everything, more loving and more spacious and more accepting and more sometimes judgmental also, and more imposing if you are not conscious of that. But you do become more. And I think that's when it becomes very important to stay humble, that everyone is on their own path. Everyone has their own lens through which they see the world. And I can only share with you my life and my truth and my reality because you're interested in learning. I don't have to share it with everyone. And And that there does need to be some humility there, not some, a lot of humility there. I do see a lot of people on social media, you know, becoming gurus all of a sudden. And it's like, that's your truth and that's your reality. And I do think that it's important to share my journey or your journey of development because it might lay the path down for someone. But to impose that on someone, no, I don't think that's right. Mm-hmm. And so for those who are struggling in your life, and if you are, you have done some of the work and you have healed more and you are capable of handling more difficult feelings, I would just say make the space. Create the space. And you have the space. Be curious. Instead of saying, let me tell you what you should do, the question should be, tell me about you. What's going on with you? How are you? What happened to you? And just hear them out. And once you start sharing, and once they start sharing, they might say, oh, I didn't realize this. And eventually they will come on and they might say, actually, you know what? I think it might be helpful for me to go to a sharing circle or to a support group or to a therapist. They will unfold in the way they're supposed to, but you can't force someone. Carl Jung said, what you resist will persist. And if you resist another person's experience, it will persist. Not just your own experience. What you resist inside of you will persist, but what you resist outside of you, like push back on, rather than soften into and open up and be curious about, that will also persist. And so there's a lot of healing that comes with just unconditional positive regard and curiosity, which is also referred to as space. So make the space, hold the space for the other person's experience.
I've been hearing that term a lot, so thank you for defining it. I love that. Thank you so much. Dr. Saliha, I usually end my episodes with a question for the guest or an opportunity for the guest to ask me a question or give me something to consider. So based on the conversation that we had today, what would you like to ask me? What would you like me to consider?
Well, my question is, you know, when we started this conversation, you were someone. And I believe through conversations we change or we have something to consider and reflect on. What will you be reflecting on from this conversation as you move forward?
Oh, I love that question. I'm going to reflect on the role that I have played in accepting a lot of the things that don't align to my value system for so long. Because I think it is easy for me to pinpoint triggers and reasons of why specific things have been, you know, not indoctrinated, but are part of me, But I also did have a role to play. And I feel like you alluding to that in, you know, when you talk about why it was a hard thing to hear, but why I felt the way that I did about Arabs. There was an acceptance in there that came from me, whatever the reason, like that acceptance was there. And I feel like that could be a core part of where my anger and my resentment this past 2 years really comes from. So I'm really going to think about that. And I love what you ended on with this idea of I can support others by simply just humbly asking questions versus trying to suggest or pinpoint things that maybe they're not ready to see yet. I like this. The whole premise of the show is asking questions. So it seems like it's a kind of an easy win there, but I love that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your vulnerability and just in being here and in sharing. I really enjoyed this episode and you really gave me and I'm sure the audience so much to consider.
Thank you, Dana.
And to all our listeners, as always, I want to thank you for the privilege of your time. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe wherever it is that you're listening. And I'll see you next time. In the meantime, I hope you found something to consider.